Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's Tom Wilson, the host of the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Big Pop Fun, the podcast with Tom Wilson. I'm Tom Wilson. I'm your lovely let's just go with lovely. I can't think of any more adjectives that describe myself that I haven't used before. Welcome back. If you're new to us, hey, welcome. They're all on the internet, so you can find all of them. And hey, settle down. Welcome to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we click our heels and float. I'll make it a Wizard of Oz reference. We're clicking our heels actually on the sleigh ride as we glide over the treetops and parking lots of the distant suburbs. And we just all get together to say, hey, Tom, let's make a shorter intro this time. And Tom clicks his teeth at the horse and says, okay, it's brought to you by my book. How about that? Have you read it? If not, would you do me a favor and read it? I think you'd like it a lot. It's called The Masked Man by Tom Wilson on the Kindle and Nook and iPad and every kind of thing. And with the economy the way it is, hey, if you roll together a few rolls of nickels, I'll come to your house and read it to you aloud. But it's been getting a lot of great reviews. And if you liked it, feel free to review it, would you? Also brought to you by Art as It Always Is. If John Polito is my guest this week, a wonderful actor. And hey, if there's a college nearby with a little theater, a little black box theater, go support young people trying to make art on stage. Go and see what they're doing. Go see what they're writing. Go and interact with them. Meet them. Tell them that you came to the play to see something interesting. And if it was interesting, tell them that. And if it wasn't, hey, maybe tell them that. But isn't that what theater is all about? And go out and support the arts and buy something that someone made or buy a ticket to something that someone wrote. We've got to support each other. Human beings trying to make and write and do stuff, which to me is kind of what it's all about. Professionally, I guess. John Polito is my guest this week. I talk about, even in my book, The Masked Man, I talk about my early beginnings in the theater. I talk about my friend Brian Morgan, who went to Villanova, who was a friend of John's, first a great mentor figure and teacher of mine back from Villanova University. I talk in the book about going to the Valley Forge Music Fair to see Victor Garber. You would know him if you saw him. He's on a lot of TV shows and movies like Titanic and stuff. But he had this kind of red afro thing. He was this hippie kid, and he played Jesus in Godspell in this touring company of Godspell that I went to see and just blew my mind. And I wanted to be an actor after that, and I wanted to do everything because it seemed like Victor Garber – you know, if you get to be Jesus in Godspell, I'll just do whatever he did. So a catalog for, I believe it was Rocky Mountain College, came to my house back when colleges would send you catalogs, literal books of what the school was about. And there's Victor Garber on the cover of the catalog. I suppose they were proud of him being an actor from there. So I thought, wow, I guess Rocky Mountain College is magic. I'll just go there to be an actor. And I didn't end up going to Rocky Mountain College. But I was around the theater department at Villanova University where Brian Morgan went and where John Polito came out of. And his relationships there led John to New York City, to working at La Mama, the theater, to work off Broadway in a million productions. And with such I was a teenager then, but it seemed so theatrical. So artsy. He was in a play with Christopher Walken. This is before Christopher Walken was a movie star or anything. And John actually went to Broadway. He was in Death of a Salesman with Dustin Hoffman and John Malkovich. And he went on to great acclaim in movies for the Coen brothers, Miller's Crossing, and on and on. Anyway, John is an historic figure, I think, in the American theater and American movies. And he's just a sweetheart of a guy. We met, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe, on the set of a TV show, as I guess I meet a lot of people now. We've always had a very, very friendly relationship. John is great, and I found it wonderful to talk to him. I hope you enjoy my conversation with my buddy, John Polito.
It's Big Pop Fox.
The Pride of Philadelphia, John. We're, you know, I often talk about Philadelphia because I'm from there, but where did you grow up in Philly?
I grew up in Southwest Philly. It was not South Philly, but we had little tones of South Philly. And we weren't West Philly, which was way too street, but we're right in between. So it was a nice little sweet street that my father moved us to, and called Shield Street. And the amazing thing about that street was my father wanted us to grow up with everybody. Most of the Italians lived in the Italian section, Germans lived in the German section, blah, 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 South Philly was South Philly, which was a battle between the Irish and the Italians. But our street had everybody on it. We just had every mixture of people. So it was a really great little street right down the street from Bartram School, which you may or may not know, which is in Philadelphia High School. So I had a high school, all the grounds of a big high school to play with, play army, all that kind of stuff. It was a wonderful, wonderful growing up in Southwest Philly.
Yeah. What'd your dad do, Mike?
My father was a contractor and a welder, and he worked for Westinghouse, which I think is still around, and a hardworking man. Also, two jobs when I was very young, so I didn't see him much then, just to keep things going. And my mom worked as well. She was pretty advanced and worked. She worked until she was in her mid-70s, actually.
What'd she do?
She was a bookkeeper, which is a term I don't even think people use anymore. But I'll tell you, it's an important thing. Keeping them books.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Were you, what kind of kid were you?
Nerd. My father was an athlete in high school, but never encouraged athletics, never watched baseball games on television. I didn't even know how to play baseball or football. I knew none of the rules. I never watched the games. That was not what he did. Huh. He was more into the arts, although he was a very big, gruff man. So my brother, who was a real nerd, 10-year-old nerd, this is before nerds were in,
sure,
as they are
before
now.
Before even the term was known.
Yeah, and boy, they weren't popular then.
Yeah.
He was into films, into special effects, into Lon Chaney, the original, into King Kong. He made stop-motion movies.
Your brother?
My brother, in our basement, in our living room. We would, whenever my brother was doing a little film, the dining room table would be covered with a miniature set. There'd be dinosaurs on it. He'd be doing stop-motion stuff, which took weeks to go through, and in those days you do it on 8mm, so it was frame by frame. You couldn't move the camera, nothing could be touched. It was pretty interesting stuff. So I was enthralled with that, and he and I were always like fire and water, always battling, but he instilled in me a love for that kind of film, special effects things, and also the old classics. So I would go to, in the Theater of the Living Arts in Philadelphia, they would have screenings of the original Lon Chaney films, the old classics, which I would go to with him or on my own. So I became very enthralled with old films, Warner Brothers films, which brings us back to this film I just finished for Warner's Gangster Squad. But we won't get to that just yet. But anyway, so that's the kind of nerdy kid I was, 10 years younger than him. I have a sister 6 years older. But very shy, very strange little kid. I was a strange little weird kid. But my friends on the street, the kids you grow up with, would try to get me involved with sports. I never knew how to play them, so I was always the last one picked, and I was screwed up. But they were interested in my interest in horror movies and all that stuff. So at least there was that kind of in. My brother used to show in 8mm things. They used to show, they'd give him miniature versions of horror films, and he would show them in the basement. He made a little theater in the basement. So the kids didn't treat me too strangely. I wasn't beat up regularly. On occasion, but not regularly.
How did your weirdness come out? How did that manifest with the kids in the neighborhood?
It didn't find itself. I was a strange, I was rather effeminate kid. I was a strange kid that couldn't find my way until I saw theater in high school. And then I wanted to be in the theater.
What play did you see?
I saw the musical at West Catholic Boys High School, which was interesting. But prior to that, when I was about 9 years old, I saw my sister at West Catholic Girls High School in a production of Anastasia. And she was playing the old lady with all that fake spray gray hair stuff. But she thought the audience didn't like her, so she started to cry when she came back out for the second act big finale, and she was really crying. And I saw her really crying, and I was convinced that was the greatest acting I'd ever seen. So, because my parents took us to see Rosemary in this play, and that influenced me with plays. My brother, of course, was about movies, and my mother... We used to have something in Philly called the 4 o'clock, the 4:30 movie. They played this theme, da dum dum dum
dum dum da dum. Yeah,
and that was something you do at 4:30. But our meals, my father came home from work around 4. We used to eat at 4:30. But if there was a special movie on there, much cut down and really crappy version of it, my mother would say, "You can take your food in there to watch that." She was very much encouraging. She saw that there was got to be a play for me. And my place was in terms of films and stuff. So I saw Bette Davis films and the old Warners and Bogart and all that in those films.
So it seems like that your young life was just absolutely designed. It carved a groove right into being an artist.
And one doesn't know that's going to happen because you're talking about a Southwest Philly kid. No connections to anything. My father's a welder. My mother's a bookkeeper. How the hell am I going to get in the business?
What do you think your dad's artistic bent was about?
Well, let me show you. We're now doing this in my condo here. All around this condo, there are these strange sculptures. My father worked at Westinghouse. There was a train. The train systems used to come into the Westinghouse to pick up the product, okay? He took railroad ties, carved them out, carved them into these African sculptures, all this stuff, burned them. They used to do a burning process with welding. He was a welder. And so they burned these things. So always there was art around. I have something on the balcony here of a sculpture that he put together of a deer. He did these things all the time. He always encouraged, he liked our art, but never pushed it. Never was like, take me to art school, nothing. He let us find our way, my brother and myself. But there was artistic feelings around the house.
Yeah, do you think that's innate, John? Do you think that's in people? Do you think your dad was, he's a strong guy, he's an immigrant, he's a bull. Like, look, I've had bulls. I mean, I could have been one of them
had I been a bull.
Right, I am a bull.
You are a bull.
I'm using that as a quotation.
Well, I believe
John Polito.
Bear is the new term. Now,
But is it inside you?
I do believe in terms of me being an Italian, it was like my father's work in the house. He rebuilt our house. My mother wanted certain things before she even moved in. He rebuilt everything, the kitchen, all the stuff. He did all the work himself. But in between our living room and our dining room was an archway that I've still to this day never seen one. It's beautiful. The way he carved it and the shape of it, it wasn't a circular archway. It was almost an egg-shaped, I don't know what that term is, and carved into the wall. His basic plastering work was art. He had to do it a certain way. He used to take me in the car on occasion if we had to go buy groceries or something, even when I was young. And I was always strange with him because I didn't know him much as a kid because he was working so hard. But he would take me around and say, I did that brickwork, or I did that archway. Or he would show me things in the neighborhood, and all of them were really exceptional. So innate, I don't know. I don't know whether it's in your system or whether there's something special you want to do.
I don't know. My grandfather was a carpenter in the same way, a bull. He was, Irishman with a black mustache and everything.
Really?
Tough.
Black Irish.
I mean, he could have passed for Cuban.
Really?
But yeah, black hair, black pencil mustache, and a strong, bull of a guy.
The same way about carpentry.
The very, very fine.
Because there was a thing about not just doing it better.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in Ireland. I haven't been to Italy all these years. I'm almost hitting my 40s now. And I've been all over Europe, haven't been to Italy. But when I was in Ireland, I felt like it was home. Because you felt culturally there was something about doing it better. I think it's part of the culture over there that we don't have here. We're all new. Everybody wants plastic here. And those guys wanted marble.
Yeah, I get late in his life, my grandfather had a stroke on one side, was completely paralyzed. And he was making bird cages with one hand. that were absolutely meticulous with these little tiny dowels that would, you know, out of wood, with like a sliding door that the birds could go in and everything. And it was, I mean, everyone would marvel at it, but like, how do you get that, well, that kind of patience?
Well, also,
and that determination.
And what you're talking about, which is funny, because you're saying something about bird cages. My father had them everywhere. He would build them out of everything and make them special and put them all over our little row home backyard. And those friggin' birds would come, and he would put certain ones under an awning so we'd have them in the kitchen to watch. He'd follow these birds, and he was very much it was one step away from nature for him, and one step away, it was always a step of perfection.
Isn't that funny? The working guys working so very hard. And honestly, when my grandfather would come home for work, which was like clockwork, because he would go out with seed and everything, the birds would literally be lined up on the fence. Oh, yeah. Lined up on all the fences
totally
of the backyard, because they knew at quarter to six, boom, he's coming out with a bag of seed, he's throwing it.
I got it. The same thing for me. Same exact thing. In a row home. Where were you raised?
He was in Delaware County in Falcroft, in a row home.
Oh, a row home? House.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Falcroft.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
So when did you start?
The great gift for me was this. It's a weird, I mean, it's a story I've told before, but I want to tell you. It's very simple. So I'm in this West Catholic. Now, we're talking about the 60s. In the 60s, there were finances around. After the Kennedys brought in the arts and the finances for some arts. Johnson carried it through. And during the 60s, there were some funds around. So high schools were pretty much encouraging their theater department and stuff. But what was happening was there was also a big movement. And I'm a Catholic. You're a Catholic. We're Catholics, and we're talking to the Catholics out there. All right. In the Christian, I was taught by nuns and then Christian brothers in high school. A Christian brother came into our high school. They did, like, you know, music house and stuff in our high school. Nothing really serious theater. But I'm a sophomore, and I'm dying to get into the theater. And I've finally gotten some course job in West Catholic Girls High School, because there was two schools, sister schools, the boys and the girls, or brother schools. And into my high school comes this Christian brother named Dominic Garvey. Dominic Garvey is studying at Villanova. He's taking his third PhD, this one in, I think, theater history. And he's going to teach at our school. And he's going to take over the theater department. We don't know this yet, but he's going to. He's a very aggressive man. He's studying at Villanova, his PhD, with... You might know these people. There was a playwright, David Rabe.
Who was very famous at Villanova
very
at that
famous.
Time.
Okay, David, before this.
Yeah.
He was just come back from Vietnam, David Rabe. And his hair was white, and he was heat. Right. You're another one. You don't look
writers
like
of Streamers and a Basic Training of Pablo Hummel.
And his daughter is now on American Horror, Lily Rabe, and she's the daughter of his with Jill Clayburgh. Anyway, David Rabe's there, a black playwright named Leslie Lee. There's these incredible people. And there is a great movement to do this new theater thing at Villanova. This guy Dominic studying there. He's at West Catholic. And he takes over the theater department. No longer is going to do musicals and high school stuff. He takes the main stage. First thing he does is a production of Guys and Dolls, which is a musical, but he keeps in the strip number, which they didn't allow in Catholic school. And he has a seminar for all the people, and he casts all the gangsters of Guys and Dolls with the football team. Lead football team, and they're all going to be in this assembly, and they naturally, the whole high school comes to the play. That ups the funds. He goes to a small theater, a small classroom in the corner of the first floor, and he converts it into a black box theater. He goes to Villanova, and he says to those guys studying their PhDs, why don't you come to West Catholic, use our students, the actor students I can put together, and you do your projects there. So he creates a liaison between Villanova and West Catholic, and they're watching my work.
Ah, so that's the connection.
That's a connection. Yeah. Now, I'm not a good student, but I'm a good artist. I'm starting to do, compose, do musicals. I'm acting pretty much in these different productions, rather adult productions. There's also a kid there who wants to be a writer. His name's Steve Revell. Steve Revell, this guy Dominic goes to Steve Revell and says, you write a play in 6 weeks, John, you write a musical in 6 weeks, I'll put it on as a double bill. My musical was called Sad Clown. Well, I was, you know, I got Italian. And Steve Revelle's play was called, I think, The Zeisterman. Steve Revelle turns out now to be the playwright who wrote Nixon, the screenwriter who wrote Nixon, wrote Ali. He's a famous, so these two of us came out of this school based on this guy, Dominic Garvey. When I graduate, I don't have any money. We're poor, and I'm going to go to maybe I don't. I want to go right to New York, but my because now I'm a theater. I'm hooked. But my mother says you're not going to. You're going to go to college. You're going to go to at least community college. Blah blah blah. So that's what I apply for, and you can go into community college and all this. In the middle of the summer, I get a call from Dominic Garvey, and he says, "John, Villanova has funds for two undergraduate theater scholarships. They don't have an undergraduate department, but I'm putting you in for one of the undergraduate scholarships. I took the boards in sophomore year and got 800, I think, for everything. I sucked. But these people in the department had seen me do different productions. And Dominic, to cinch it, puts me into a production of Indian Wants the Bronx that he, I think it was that, and puts it on in front of those people as an audition, and I get a full paid scholarship to Villanova.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Not for living there, but all my to enter Villanova.
Sure.
Way out of my league.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Main Line's way out of Southwest Philly's league. You know,
right,
I mean,
right.
Unless you got a connection. So that's it. So I went in there and did an undergraduate theater scholarship. I screwed up the first year, which is another weird thing. I screwed up the first year so badly. They put me in eight plays because they knew I could act. So they put me in everything, and I'm writing stuff, and I'm doing stuff. Totally screw up my marks. So I lose my scholarship freshman year. Lose it. My mother, this is why my mother, I said, saved my life several times in my life. This is one of them. She goes to the head of the arts department and she says, we will pay, my husband and I will pay for a full year's tuition if you wipe out his freshman year and reinstate his scholarship afterwards. If he makes, what do you need? He said, mm-hmm. Well, we need at least a C, but probably a B. Okay, he will do that. If he doesn't do it, forget it. And he says, no, we can't do that. You can't drop a scholarship and pick up. Yes, you will do it. No, we will. Yes, you will do it. She convinced this guy, and I know for a fact it wasn't like Sally Field who slept with in Forrest Gump. She didn't sleep with this guy. He was a priest. But she convinced him, and he let me do this, and they let me do it. So I then repeated my freshman year, which in the end saved my life because
wow.
Vietnam, I was number 17 in the draft. And had I been on my normal four-year thing, I would have gone right into Vietnam. I would have gone right into the Tet Offensive. Exactly, because everybody I knew, I lost, I guess we lost four guys that I would have graduated with who went right to Vietnam and were killed very quickly. So I always considered my mother saved my life by pushing for this thing. And that meant it was a five-year Villanova stint, but really a four-year education, and that's what I did. And there at Villanova, they had no undergraduate department. They gave me free rein. They let me do whatever. I was doing films for my classes over here. I was acting over here. I was directing over here. And then they formed a theater company, a sort of semi-professional one. And David Rabe was becoming very famous in New York, and so we had a liaison between New York and Philly. So we really were doing pretty serious stuff.
I wasn't a little kid at that time, but I was in I was before high school. But coming up into high school, I lived a quarter mile from the Villanova campus, and Villanova was such an artistic hotbed.
It was.
There was theater happening. Yeah. Jim Croce had gone to Villanova, so it was like the parts of the folk movement and parts of this theater movement.
It was in the papers all the time. Villanova.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you would have. I mean. People knew. The community supported us, too.
And you were at Villanova, as we've talked about, with my very good friend and teacher, Brian Morgan.
Oh, Brian
and
Morgan.
With Marianne Carlson Morgan, his wife. Yeah. Brian's passed away for years now. But Brian had come out of that department in that same hotbed of theatrical creativity to my high school.
Yeah, which was right up the road. And everyone who was there, the people that were studying graduate school there, everybody there, everybody had a glow about them and an absolute blind belief in the arts because of our education.
Absolutely, which
that has influenced you.
It's influenced me beyond anything I can describe.
You're not the only one. I know how much influence Brian had on other people. And Brian, yes, was right out of there was theater. Our acting teacher, a woman named Irene Baird, had just come from – New York, this guy, Bob Headley, who started to run the...
I know Bob. Bob. Who ran the Philadelphia company for many years.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And Bob, and there was Richard Dupre, who originally ran the place. But they were getting people from New York. I'm still friends with... Irene, I'm still friends with, and this is like, what, 40 years as my acting teacher. But there was a designer who came one year. She's still one of the top artists, supported New York Times, gives her raves every time. She came in for just one season and changed my life as a designer, and she taught me film. She introduced me to Ingmar Bergman films, all this kind. It was amazing what that 4 years meant.
But your experience in high school and mine of Brian, and you're at a high school theater department, which is doing Arsenic and Old Lace, or which is doing musical, which is fun. But, Brian comes in to the theater department and says, we're doing The Crucible. We're doing an adaptation of Frankenstein. Yeah. And the first rehearsal for The Crucible is we're just going to improvise on the scenes.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'll pause it. I'll pause it for a second.
God, that was Hollywood calling. I believe Spielberg wants people.
but improvising within themes of The Crucible, scene by scene, or Frankenstein, where Brian takes me aside. I'm a high school kid, and he says, "I think really, this is about a tortured soul." You know, we think it's a horror thing. We think it's a Halloween show
did
or
you
something.
Play Frankenstein?
I play the creature. And he's taking me aside to have all of these conversations about the mind, the psychology of the creature, of the loneliness of somebody who, and he says, how about, I think maybe he has an incredible speech impediment.
Oh, that's
because his brain, there's something wrong. This is an absolutely tortured soul. So I do this entire performance with this incredible, speech impediment and all kinds of torture. And it was just a different thing. Like the audience reacted, and I was a kid, but the audience reacted in a different way from anything like a normal audience would react.
It was art.
It was art. It was affecting.
It wasn't just a high school person.
They didn't even know what they just saw, but they know like that thing was...
There were times when there was confusion in the audience in many of the productions I was in, but they never said it was boring. It was... It may have been high school, but it was odd.
That's right. That's right. So did you go from Villanova?
I tried to do New York and very quickly came back because I realized you needed a backup. You had to support yourself, and I had not finances. I knew someone in New York and went up to test it out for maybe a month. And then I realized, wait a minute, New York's got to be a battle. So I came back. My brother introduced me to some casting people who put me in an industrial. They were still doing films in Philadelphia, like for industrial things. I did that for my SAG card. And Richard Dupre, who had originally done Villanova, but had now moved to the Walnut Street Theater, a great old standard in Philadelphia, and he was forming a new company. So he hired me there as a member of the company. And then there was a children's theater company that worked out of Philly. They hired me to do Robin Hood, and I got my equity card. So now I have my SAG card and my equity card. In that production of Robin Hood, by the way, was Peter Riegert. Do you know who he is?
Sure, Peter.
Wonderful Peter. And that was the first time I met Peter. Some good people in that production, actually. It was quite historic. And so I had my union cards, and I worked there from September to May 1st. May 10th, I moved to New York that year and had $1,000 in my pocket. That was a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
It was a lot of money back then.
And so, did you work odd jobs in New York, or did you really start? Because you were part of a very, you were in a lot of really great and historic plays.
Here's what's weird. At Villanova, when I was in the company, Ellen Stewart, who is called La Mama, she was the head of the off-Broadway movement. She came down to Philadelphia, and she gave a lecture for our company. Everybody was very, very serious with her. I, not so much. So when I raised my hand to speak to her, this is maybe, I'm about 260 pounds now. This is the beginning, the first year of the company, theater company, which would have been about 1970. And she gave this lecture, and I raised my hand, and I said, Miss Stewart, how do you be a star? And everybody moaned and groaned. And she's serious. She looks up to me. She says, it was an old kind of kind of like a witch-like, not unlike a witch in some ways, but a spiritual person. And she looks at me and she says, "Well, dear, you'll have to want it enough." And then that was it. She turned away from me. That was all I said, 1970. I lose 100 pounds. I'm doing all these different things. I go through that. I go to Philadelphia, all the stuff. I go to New York. This is 3.5 years later. I don't know anybody. I don't know anybody. I'm staying with a buddy of mine from Villanova. He doesn't know anybody. I don't know anybody. He's trying to do anything for theater. I'm trying to do. I've been there now a month. I think I'm going to die if I don't work immediately. It's now June. It's July. In July, I have tracked down Ellen Stewart's home phone number. I have tried it in June, no answer, and I'm now in July. And I call, drunk as a skunk, 1 o'clock on a Saturday night, because I haven't reached her, I forget, just for the fun of it. I call, and she picks up the phone. And I say, Mr., you're never going to remember me. My name is John Polito. And she said, "You are a heavyset boy who wants to be a star."
Are you kidding me, John?
Swear to God. She is psychic. And I said, "Well, Miss Stewart, I'm not heavy anymore." She said, "You will come in tomorrow. We've just lost the lead of a play, and you will read for this, and it will start your career." I said, "What?" She goes, "Tomorrow, 1 o'clock, be at the Truck and Warehouse Theater on 8th Street." Well, that was it. This is true. So I walk into this friggin' theater. The play's called Language. Now that I've been there, but I say about almost 2 months. It's called Language, written by a guy named David Starkweather, directed by him, and it's a fiasco. It's an epic. It is 2.5 hours of arts and finding yourself, but it's at the Truck and Warehouse Theater. It's a great produced thing by La Mama, and I'm the lead. I'm the sexually confused. No, I'm the gay guy in my underwear. There's a guy who's kind of bisexual. It was the 60s, darling. It was in the 70s. Everybody was bisexual. And he is playing this one figure, and I'm in love with him, and so is this girl in love with him. And he's a sculptor, and he's making this big sculpture on the stage, blah, blah, blah. I'm in my underwear for the first act, and then slowly beginning to assemble clothes as I become more together. In production, I dress a little more. It was off Broadway theater. But David Starkweather was a historic playwright for Off Broadway Movement. It was reviewed in the New York Times. And I get a nice review. So bang. And then we're a hit. So we're going to run. So I make money. And I'm reviewed in the New York Times after 2.5 months. About 2 months after that, I run into a friend of mine from Philadelphia, Anne DeSalvo, who I'd known in high school. I didn't remember her, but she said, "Oh, we were in plays together." I didn't remember. But she said, I'm doing this thing at the Direct Theater called The Transfiguration of Benno Blimpie by a guy from Philadelphia named Albert Inarrado. And I said, "I don't know, well, that's great and all." She said, "I'll call you if anything happens." Because I was to make money, I would work as an equity monitor. You would collect the equity cards and you'd make $15 a day. Well, $15 a day was a lot of money to me if I made it 3 or 4 days a week. Plus, I went a little unemployment from my children's theater thing. Whatever it was, I was living on nothing. But I had an apartment that was very cheap, $125 a month, and I was able to do it. Anyway, Anne DeSalvo gives me a call about 4 nights later and said, "We lost our lead. They want you to. I recommended you should read for this play." This friggin' play is magnificent—a one-act play called "The Transfiguration of Benno Blimpie," about a man who eats himself to death, and it's written by Albert Inarrado, a Philadelphia playwright who had been at Yale. And it's the Yale people that are producing it, and it's the beginning of the Playwrights Horizons people, but they're called the Direct Theater, and it gets reviewed in the New York Times. And I got a very good review. And James Coco passed away. He comes to see it, and they're going to produce it, and it's a big deal. And then the next play by Albert Inarrado.
Go ahead.
And Albert Inarrado's next play called Gemini is going to be produced, and they're going to do it on a double bill. It's a big deal. All of a sudden, I'm in. I'm doing off Broadway, and I'm being reviewed in the New York Times, and I'm playing leads, and all. And that was it. That was the extent of my struggling. I was pretty much in the theater.
Wow.
I never had another job. One thing I did. A funny story was. When I first arrived, and I was staying with my buddy Michael Morin, who's passed away, he had a little apartment on 21st and 8th, first floor of this place. And there was T-shirts at the time were being painted, and it was still a carryover from the 60s, and denim was being painted, and I was an artist. I also paint, I write music, I do all this stuff. So I told this guy in this little shop that I could paint, and I could do stuff. And he said, oh, great, I'm going to open up a T-shirt painted factory. Why don't you run it for me, blah, blah, blah. I'll pay you $250 a week. That's how I thought, okay, great. I really didn't want to do it. I just wanted to do the theater, but I was actually kind of scamming him. But he was kind of scamming me anyway. So I took this job. But I also had no money to stay alive as we were setting up this T-shirt factory. And I had heard about the $10,000 pyramid, that television show, Dick Clark show. And I knew friends who won money on it. So I went to buy the equipment. I didn't even know how to use an airbrush, an art airbrush, but I bought it down in the Soho area and was whisking my way back to Michael's apartment to watch the $10,000 pyramid because I was supposed to go on the next morning. I was chosen. There's another reason I was chosen. I'll tell you that in the way it begins, but that's part of my bio. But anyway, I'm whisking back, cab driver, I jump into a cab, I'm holding all this airbrush crib, and he said, where to? I said, get me to 21st and 8th right away. And he goes, no problem. He turns the corner and slams into another car. I go forward, my nose is broken, all this blood is pouring out. He wants to rush me to the hospital. I say, no, get me to 21st and 8th. I've got to watch the $10,000 piece. So he runs me there. I'm pouring blood. I'm watching the episode. I finally realize I'm in bad trouble. My nose is broken and this thing won't stop bleeding. So I'm rushed to St. Vincent's Hospital. And they stitch me up very badly. And I'm there until 2 in the morning. My friend Michael, when I walk in, says, what the hell happened? There's blood all over my nose. Blah, blah, blah. He said, well, what are you doing? I said, tomorrow I got to wake up at 7. I got to get to the $10,000. This is all in between when I'm going to do this play. And I run, go on the set. And they said, you can't be here. You got a brace on you. I said, no problem. I take the brace off. I put makeup on. I'm doing it. And I freaking go on television. And it's a simple show. They ask you simple questions. And there I am in front of a live audience. And they put me on.
With a broken nose.
With a broken nose.
Covered in makeup.
Blood and makeup and Band-Aids. Dick Clark says, what happened to you? And I said, these New York cab drivers. Laugh from the audience. I'm looking at Dick Clark, and all of a sudden, all the drugs are kicking in. I'm delauded to death. I don't know what the hell's happening. I'm spinning. My head's spinning. And she turns, and Joanne Flew, she was somebody from the movie MASH, turns to me and says the first clue, which is Mexican hat.
Sombrero?
You got it, but I didn't.
You didn't know.
I was hospitalized. So I'm looking at her like she's totally crazy. Her eyelashes are blinking. Mexican hat. Mexican hat. I don't get sombrero. It goes to the next clue, and I lose, and I don't get any money. So I'm now broke. I'm working on a T-shirt factory for 2 weeks. I then dropped that job because I got the play language and the rest of it. That's the only other job I had was painting T-shirts. You can hear how bad I was at that, and I was no good on the $10,000 pyramid either. Obviously, I had to be an actor.
You had to be an actor.
There was nothing else there.
When you're that young and people are – making phone calls saying, hey, the lead of this incredible play just dropped out. Is it, yeah, does it connect with you?
Or do you just. It never did. And then here's what happens to finish that story. And I have told this in another interview. 8 years later, I'm going to win an Obie Award, Best Actor Award. And I'm at the Obies. I didn't know I was going to win. I was invited for the season I did at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And I'm there. Ellen Stewart, the same woman, is there. And she wins her 54th Obie Award for being a genius. And then I win Best Actor of the Year. And I'm flipped out. So I think I've got to reach Ellen Stewart. I got to thank her. I got to thank her. So I run up behind her. And I said, Miss Stewart, it's John Polito. She looks at me. I said, remember you started me in the play? She goes, I have no idea who you are. And she walks out the door. Okay? So I'm flipped out. However, 30 years to the same week, it's May, 30 years later, and my wonderful friend that I told you I knew from Villanova still, her name is Theodora Skipateras, I go into New York and I visit her and she goes, do you want to see Ellen? She's not well. I said, Ellen? She goes, Ellen Stewart. I said, she'll never remember me. She said, no, you got to go see her because I know how important. So I go with my friend Theo to visit the not so well Ellen Stewart, who's now in her 90s, Well, she's pretty good, actually. She's directing the Trojan Women thing. There's puppets in her theater. And I am on the balcony, and I see her working. She's directing all these people. And there's these massive puppets. And I go out on the balcony while we're waiting for rehearsal to end. And there's the Truck and Warehouse Theater, now renamed. The place I started is 30 years later, the same week. And I turn around, and I sit down next to Miss Stewart as she's finishing, and she's having her lunch. And I turn to all the puppeteers, and I start to say, I have to tell you, because they know me from movies, I have to tell you people how I started. And I start to tell the story. This woman came to Villanova, bum, 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 and she says to me, you will start your career, bum, 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 bum. And she's looking at me now, 90-year-old, and she's looking at me and looking at me, and she then finally, I finish the story, and I say, so that's how I started. Miss Stewart, I want to thank you. And she said, is that true, baby? And I said, yes, Miss Stewart, it is true. And she said, hey, give me some sugar. And she pointed to her cheek, and I kissed her cheek, and I thanked her 30 years later.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful, man. Well, I don't want to take too much of your time. We have to get.
Well, you know Hollywood's calling. I think Hollywood's
you've
calling.
You've been in movies. I must tell you though, John, that out of that Villanova experience and our relationships there, we all have those things, those four or five times when a person came up and said something to us that we just remember. And I was doing 110 in the Shade.
Yeah.
At the Pasadena Playhouse. And we had talked about this before when we met on television doing a guest thing on TV.
Yeah, I remember, but I don't remember what it was.
But we had talked about it. Anyway, you came to the play, and you came backstage. You were in a hurry. You were with friends and everything.
You're the one I want to see because I love you.
You came up to me and just said, you know, Brian would be so proud of you.
Oh, did I really?
You did.
Oh, I'm so glad.
You did. And it's...
I'm so glad you're choking up.
It's choking.
It's what we Catholics do.
Yeah. But it's one of those things that meant a great, great deal to me. It was a very, very touching thing of you
also,
to do.
Also, you were great in that play. And that was an important play, the 110 for me in the past. And I hadn't seen it in ages. And you were great in that play.
Yeah.
Nice role. Nice production.
It was, we had a wonderful
time. And
Brian,
the fact was, and that's why even, it was really funny. I was watching the Oscars last night and Michelle Obama comes on and she's talking about very not so subtly hinting arts in the schools before she announces Best Picture nominations. My career was based on funding for arts in high schools. Your career was based on a man who came from that funding, just the way I came from that funding, Brian Morgan. This is something that the effect goes on and on. What's happening now, and I'm sorry to say, is all kids are going after. My nieces and nephews, I want to come to Hollywood. Why? I want to be a star. They don't want to do the work. They don't want to act.
Well, that's what I say too.
But it's because they're not given a sample of what is it like to be an actor.
I don't think there. Do you think there are? Do you see shows now where kids can get that feeling that you got, where there's something magical happening on stage, where it's with some art that you're going, wow, this thing is wow.
No, I don't. Well, I saw a wonderful theater group, the guy Marcus Flanagan. Do you know the actor Marcus Flanagan?
I don't think so.
This is up on the 101. They have some funding up there. Their money, it's a religious school, I believe. It's an Episcopalian or something. Some of the religious school, but they have funding for their productions, and they do pretty good ones. So therefore, there are these little pockets of places. And then when I saw Glee come on television, I thought, come on, give everybody goddamn, although I don't know what it's supposed to be, a Glee Club. It's full productions as far as I'm concerned. but I was hoping that would inspire people for the arts. Right now, what has to happen... and. I guess what got me was when I remember when they were having the presidential elections with Clinton and that strange guy who was against him, not Bush, but he had a really funny little voice. He was the third candidate, the independent. And I remember him talking, bringing up charts about when the country was at its best. And it was in the 60s, there was the most money in the country. But it was also, and yet monies were going out for funding and for programs. And you thought, my God, does that in some way, does funding for schools actually work in your favor? It will in the end. And I'm hoping that comes back to schools and kids get a chance to be artists. And somebody mentioned it last night, or maybe it was, I think it was last night. Because one of the documentary guys who won last night in the Oscars, which you didn't see, a documentary was about a woman who's a great artist, a kid, 14, 15 years old. She doesn't have an arts program. But these people found her, and this one arts program thing that organized funded her, and she's a great artist, 14, 15 years old. And the fact is, I believe if you have an artist, I just got to talk about myself now. If I wasn't an artist, I'd be a friggin' mass murderer. I believe that that kind of whatever that energy is has to be placed in the arts. Or if not, it'll go to crime or something else. It's major energy. The artists, I believe, need to be supported or given some outlet.
Yeah.
I think the arts need an outlet. Just the way, because an artist is not like a sports person who can get it out physically. They have brain energy in an artist. You're physical. You're one of that few that's a physical person to get it off and also an artist. For me, I wasn't physical, so all that brain energy, I felt, so it's got to be funded, it's got to be supported, it's got to have some outlet, and hopefully it will.
And people have to go see it, which is what I say on this. If there's a black box theater at your college, go see what they're doing.
Oh, please.
Just go see what they're doing.
Exactly.
They're really very interesting things.
Exactly. And the funny thing is, we're in a Los Angeles situation, which is real tough, because, I mean, I'm going to little towns where I've seen these little theaters. I couldn't believe they were so much better than what is in L.A. because L.A. theater is poo-pooed on. It's not supported as well as it should be, other than the Amundsen and the bigger productions. And I support a theater called the Elephant Theater, which is on Santa Monica, one block west of Vine. And that theater has real good theater, wonderful actors in it. Original productions, and it's like a
great, you could see something great. My daughter got a degree in drama at UC Irvine here, and we went to a black box theater there and saw these little shows. I'm saying, I haven't seen anything this good in 20 years. I mean, it's really fantastic.
Yeah. And I've got a guy named Les Ferrar, a wonderful friend of mine since the 70s, who is at the L.A. City College. And he's doing incredible theater, not only incredible theater with his people, but his productions are moving out into more professional ways because these productions are so good. He just did an Andy Warhol piece that's probably going to go to New York, but it's been playing all over town because people keep on wanting to go there. And it's all these kids brilliantly acting because he's a great director. He influences these kids to be great artists. And he is someone I'm watching who will be the same figure to them that my figures were to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing it on his own. It's a nice little arts thing they got there. But since Les Ferrar has been at this place, it has been art. And he's doing great work. He's a great artist.
Yeah. When, did you just move to L.A. in order to get into movies?
No, I was going back and forth. It was a funny thing. I'm 30. I'm about 29 years old. 29. I win the Obie Award. And I'm going back to do some play at Manhattan Theater Club or something. And I was doing Miss Julie, that's right, also at the Roundabout or the Manhattan Theater Club production of Miss Julie. I had the lead. And I'd heard about the show called Gangster Chronicles, and I read for it, and they said, you're good, but we're not going to cast this out. We're going to cast it in L.A., blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I'm doing this play, and I'm not so fond of the play. My parents come to see it, and I say to them, you know, there's a possibility I would like to go to L.A. and audition for that television show again. And my father says, my mother goes, can't you go back to college? Can't you go back and get a backup to you? You know, that kind of thing. And my father says, no, Dee, let him go. Let him go. I'll pay for you to go, he says. Go out there and audition for the show. So I fly out on a Friday. I audition on Monday. And before I get home, I got the job. So my first audition here was the show called Gangster Chronicles with Brian Benben and Madeline Stowe and Marky Post and all these people. It's a big gangster history of the Lucky Luciano and all those people. It's going to be their whole history because Fred Silverman at the time realized The Godfather was getting such great ratings. Why not just do the whole history of gangsters? And it was done at Universal. So I walk out here my first day, I get an audition as a gangster, and I do that. So I'm here. I finish it up by saying, no, I don't want to be in television. I want to go back to the theater. So I go back to New York. And I'm coming out here for shows. I don't go back in that. Blah, blah, blah. So I go back and forth until finally I do Death of a Salesman, and then I do another play, and I start getting movies, and then I come
out. Can we stop for Death of a Salesman for a minute?
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
That was That was, a very celebrated
and famous. The other Hoffman, the Dustin Hoffman, the new Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman with...
John Malkovich.
With John Malkovich. Arthur Miller was still alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And he
was around the whole production.
Yeah, he was around the whole production. Yeah. A production that was... That was famous among actors for not as difficultly in just histrionics in people being terrible with each other as some productions will have, but in that really working the play with Arthur Miller being there.
Absolutely. And also as CBS, when's the last time you saw CBS saying, that's so good, we want to produce it as a film? So they brought it on television as well. It was historic.
It was
historic for the 80s, yes.
It was historic for the 80s and a very seminal production for actors.
Yeah.
For actors to watch.
Well, Malkovich had come in the year before and was quite a stir. And when the idea came that we're going to have small little Dustin Hoffman playing much against his age, and he's cast, of all people, John Malkovich, the new black in theater. You know, I mean, he is, not that he's a black person, but he's
no,
new
the new from person. Steppenwolf and
Steppenwolf
all that stuff and all.
Barely in New York, and you're going to have him. So we know Hoffman's not going to fuck around. I don't know whether you can say that here, but he's not going to screw around with. He's going to surround himself with really great actors. And Kate Reid, a real bull of a woman who was known for initially playing on the matinees of the original Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I mean, these were powerhouse people that he was starting to surround himself with. And Miller was going to be involved, so it was quite historic. I went after a role of a small part. They wanted me to read because they couldn't get a commitment from Malkovich. This story has been told before. They couldn't get a commitment from Malkovich to run, and I had done a play very similar to True West, which brought Malkovich into town. So they wanted me to read for Biff, the son, and I wouldn't do it. I told them I only wanted to read for a very small part named Howard, the guy who fires him in the death of a salesman scene. When he talks about the death of a salesman, it's in the beginning of the second act. And I went after this role, and I got it. And that was very important to my career.
You were magnificent in it.
Not that great in the movie version because Dustin had a little too much directorial influence, if you ask me.
Influence in the editing or in what you were doing?
In the whole production. Dustin Hoffman was brilliant on the stage because he was not so sure-footed, and he loved the magic of every night and a new performance every night.
Because it was discovery?
It was discovery for him. Initially, he would have a problem when we were rehearsing, like if the wire recorder didn't spin in front of him, he would go crazy, even though the audience couldn't see it, because he could see it. And then slowly he began to realize it was going to be, and the way he played with all of us was magic. He orchestrated it so everybody was allowed to do whatever they wanted every night within the structure as long as something new happened. Even if it was just a little glimmer in the eye. He wanted that play to be vibrant every night, and we all were. There was no rules. You played the blocking, but you could make magic every night based on whatever magic was happening that night. He made it an interesting one-year run. However, when it got to the film version, he chose Volker Schlondorf. I patoo him. But he was a director who had done something called The Tin Drum years before, and it was European, and everything in European things with stars is the great artist Dustin. So basically, the same accidents did not happen in the film version that happened in any number or any one of the performances on the stage. So I didn't feel the production was as fresh on when it was recorded.
Because when it was being recorded, everyone felt like they had to get into the groove of what they did the last time?
No, because when I felt that the director was pretty much pandering to Dustin. The great part about Hoffman, the great part about all the great artists that I've worked with, is they're truly not divas in the way that they absolutely don't want to be challenged. They want to be challenged. And you have to play with them. You have to play ball. You're playing with a great, great athlete, let's say. So they're fine as long as you can come up to bat.
I think you're absolutely right, John. I think that that's the thing. I don't think that – well, of course, there are some temperamental crazy people.
Oh, there's that,
of course. That's a big slice of the pie.
Yes.
But a lot of times when I'm on the set, and maybe you might disagree, but let's see, I think that artist just wants to make sure that that director, like you said, baseball, whatever, you'd better be able to pitch 95 miles an hour because this is the pros. You know, I'm not fooling around up here.
And they want their co-star. You know what it's like when we're walking into these things as an actor. They want to know that their co-star is going to come up with the goods too. That when you're,
oh, absolutely.
You're walking in, they just want to know, I'm the pro. You could play a pro game with me. Not to say anybody's going to win, but I want a match.
Exactly.
I've always said that. I always compare. I didn't do sports, but I considered theater. I had a great, great influence in my life in college, a guy who we haven't talked about. But his whole thing was he had no time for anything stayed. He wanted sports. He wanted it to be a new game every night. Hoffman was the same way on the stage. They just want the challenge of, if I serve, can you hit back? And if you hit back strong, can I keep up to you? They want to play great. I mean, come on. I work with Brando, Faye Dunaway, Dustin Hoffman. All of them were the same. They just wanted to work.
Of just making that eye contact and making it happen. And they throw something your way, and you can bat it right back at them. And they say, and it's thrilling when they say, ah, we're in.
Good work. If they lean across. Yeah. Hoffman, fucking, what's his name? Brando was like, I'm going to do this. You don't mind, do you? I was like, hey, what am I going to say? He liked it. I liked it. And we're doing fine. Uh-huh. That's magic. And Hoffman was like that and a great influence. Hoffman was a great influence on me film-wise because that's the first time I realized when Hoffman said, that's the first time I realized, because I'm an old theater boy. I always did performances the same. When I did Death of a Salesman, he turned and said, we did it once like that. Do it again a different way. It's in the can. That was the first time I learned that film was like theater, so keep on rehearsing in front of the camera. Film was a very hard adjustment to me because my performances were okay before I was 35, but they weren't very good. They were too staid and too simple and too repetitive in terms of I did each take this the same for continuity. And the real fact was Hoffman, when I worked in Salesman, that then led to my other I began to do real films after that, The Highlander and all these things. And then I went and did the show Crime Story and in Chicago, and that was a great life lesson too. But what I learned was, and what was lovely was, why am I a good actor on the stage? Well, because I'm playing in front of an audience. Why am I not a good actor? Why can't I look at my own work on the film? Well, because you're performing for the camera. So I had to eliminate, and I was raised around cameras, so I had to eliminate the camera as being a focus and the person I played to. So what I did was I got to know the cameraman's name, the focus puller's name, the wardrobe person's name, the prop person's name, and all of them, the extended group of crew became my front row of an audience. So when I played, I then began to play to them as opposed to the camera, and then my work became good on camera. I think that was important for me.
Boy, I think that's very true. I mean, all I say to actors, I don't know much. I've performed in front of the camera a lot. And all I can say is just forget it's there.
Yeah.
Just don't pay any attention.
I won't forget it's there. I can't forget it's there. It's there. And it's clicking. And it's making noises. And people are next to it. And they're moving. I couldn't forget it was there. What I had to do was say, I can't make it the important center. I had to handpick. If you go to a prop person, if you go to wardrobe and you make sure you tell them I'm going to do this with my shirt and I'm going to do this with that prop, therefore they're going to want to see what you're going to do and they'll be there watching. I extended my front row audience. Rather than saying forget it's there, just make it part of the group of 12. Your lighting guy's up there and make that whole thing an audience. That's what I had to do. You're saying forget the camera's there or you're instructing people. I couldn't because I know the camera. So I had to make sure it was just one of many I was performing to. That's what I did. So you're saying forget it's there, meaning don't make it the main focus. The same message is there, which is don't make the camera the focus of what you're performing for.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know your stuff. You've been around since the beginning of time.
I don't know about that. But so, you know, I can't break them down film by film, but within your film work, the Coen brothers.
Coen brothers is the best.
Yeah.
All the way around, they've extended me the best in terms of their performances.
And where did that come from? Just an audition and going
Miller's
to meet them?
Miller's Crossing, I had to go after pretty much because I was too young to play the part initially. And now, of course, it's there. But I did get the Miller's Crossing gangster. which was initially going to be opposite Trey Wilson, their actor who played Arizona in Raising Arizona. But Trey passed away the weekend we were starting shooting. And then Albert took over, which scared me because Albert Finney has 20 years on me. So I was afraid we wouldn't look like the peers that we were supposed to be. But in fact, it works quite well. I mean, I think even now, I think I look about the same age as I look then. But in my 40s, when I was blowing up in fat, I had that older person look, and so the banter was good. Then that was a gangster. Then they wrote a part for me in Barton Fink, which I didn't want to do because I wanted to play the Michael Lerner's part. But I was convinced by Franny McDormand that I should do it, and that was a very good extension of my performing because that part was such a nerd and completely opposite the gangster. Then I did nothing really special in Hudsucker, but I had a nice, crazy fat man role in Big Lebowski, and then I had a great role in The Man Who Wasn't There, which was one of their most unsuccessful films, but it's a great, great role that they wrote with me in mind.
And it was, and the filming process was great for you. You enjoyed doing the movies.
All of them. All of them. The Coens are magic beyond belief. They never really direct, but they always
direct. Yeah, I wonder, how did
they
two guys...
They direct very strongly, but it's always like, well, you know, that was good, but like, and then Ethan would say, you know, I think you could do it a little bit more, and Joel would say, maybe a little faster, and I'd say, faster and louder, funnier, and they go, yeah, that's it, try that. So basically, you thought you were always coming up with the ideas, but it was really them slowly orchestrating you right into what mm-hmm. they wanted. They wanted magic. Like in Miller's Crossing, if anybody knows that film, the opening scene was initially going to be shot as a single takeoff of The Godfather, a big dolly shot, and it didn't work. So they had to go back and reshoot it again, which is very unusual for the Coens. And but they didn't interfere with me in terms of what I was doing because they had cast me. But I know musically they had wanted me to not pause at one thing, but I couldn't seem to do it right. Everything was about that. Of course, they've changed a lot since Miller's. Miller's was, they were still on their kind of way up, and now they're just like it's a wonderful factory when you're with them. They're brilliant, and everybody just jumps right in, and the dialogue's so brilliant, it's like easy. You know, I mean, they're geniuses. I've always said that I always loved the Warner Brothers films, and I loved Orson Welles and all that stuff, and I feel that the Coens are the closest thing in this modern day to working with like an Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater, those old-time things where you had companies of actors. For a while, I was in five films of theirs, not recently, although I begged them to be in A True Grit, because I said, there's nothing like me and buttless chaps. But they said, absolutely not, we don't want to see your butt, and that was the end of that moment.
So when we first met, you had come in to replace an actor on an episode of a TV show.
Do you remember what it was?
It was called Fired Up. I was doing a recurring role.
Oh, my God. Fired
Up. With Sharon Lawrence.
Kelsey produced.
Mm-hmm. And you came – the actor there, it was a scene where you – it was sort of – cell phones were sort of newish, and you were almost like a gunfight at the OK Corral. You were drawing your cell phone with one of the characters.
With Jonathan Banks. Wasn't Jonathan?
Yeah, with Johnny Banks was on the show, yeah.
So, we had a big confrontation, I remember, at the end, about like a
Exactly. With calling on a cell phone or something.
Yeah, something.
And they had an actor there who was a man of wide experience, but just was his taking it seriously. You took it seriously. And the joke wasn't there. I remember his face, and he's been in a million things, and he was a very nice man. But at the end of the day, it was just like, it's the funny thing was, as seriously as he took that, it wasn't funny.
Wow.
So they just, they replaced him. You came on. And of course, we hadn't met at that point. And at that point, I said, oh, wow, from the theater and from, you know, that, you'd see the, whatever, a Death of a Salesman because it's too long a story, but we watched, me and the cast of the movie April Fool's Day, a horror movie from Paramount, were shooting up in Canada, and the whole cast went to one person's hotel room up on location to watch that Death of a Salesman on TV on CBS.
It was a big event.
Big event. So we all watch all of Death of a Salesman, and it's so fantastic, and you're so good. It was so fantastic, and somebody clicks off the TV, and I mean, it was silent. because we're all up in the Canada somewhere filming it.
I saw kind of
schlocky kind of, you know, a horror movie with kids getting killed and everything.
Where did you stay?
So the Craig Flower Motel in Victoria.
God.
Yes.
Oh my God, but, Jesus!
But we were kind of just, oh man, they're doing. Look at that, man. So anyway, so of course, I knew you. My point being, the first time we do the scene, you get out of this booth from the restaurant,
and it's this
showdown with Johnny Banks, yeah. And you take out the cell phone completely seriously, and everybody dies, everybody busts a gut.
Well, that's nice to hear. I don't remember it, but thank
what
you.
I'm asking, I guess, is that through time on stage, knowing the difference and being able to fine tune it so finely that you can go between. Absolutely straight into play.
Well, it's the old
to
story.
Something right
where your comedy's like drama and your drama's like comedy and you're in good shape. I don't know. I don't know what that is. I do know if I see it in the music of the dialogue, I know how to play the double-edged thing. I mean, really, when you look at a lot of my Miller's Crossing, it's kind of a serious performance, but it gets a lot of laughs. I don't know what that is. Is it theater? Is it just skill, talent? Genius.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I often quote Neil Simon, who said, you know, comedy is played, you played exactly like drama,
yeah.
Except a little more seriously.
That's very interesting. Is that what he said?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Which
I don't know what those things are, and I never know what the key is. I've been very fortunate that I would say I don't remember ever being in a situation in a comedy, especially on television shows, where it didn't work the way I had wanted it to work, or better. I remember when I was doing, when I filmed Miller's Crossing, here's one moment. I do remember when I filmed Miller's Crossing, I remember knowing, if I play this way, it'll get that laugh in the audience, film audience, so I better give a breather afterwards. Now, I actually remember physical pacing with gesture to cover the laugh, hoping it would come.
Right.
Now, I remembered that there was one moment in that movie that I was convinced was the bomba moment. This one's going, I'm going to hold for days. This laughter is good. Not a friggin' chuckle. To this day, it sucks, this moment. That was the only time I really, truly failed. For the most part, though, Miller's Crossing, I remember sitting there. We opened at the New York Film Festival, and everything that I had wanted to be funny was funny. That was important. I remember saying to Michael Lerner, it's funny, Michael Lerner was in Barton Fink, and I said, your performance is brilliant, Michael, but you ain't giving them time to laugh.
Oh, yeah?
And I still believe that to this day, because when I watch Barton Fink, you miss half of Michael Lerner's performance, because he goes at such a pace, but he never gave himself... It's brilliant what he's doing, but there's no room for... So... What you're saying is, I do believe I still have that friggin' theater ear.
Mm-hmm.
Not hold for laugh, but make sure that there's a laugh there. You're giving yourself enough room to, and in film performances, you've got to be able to pace it so that if you're going to hopefully get a laugh, that you're going to be able to hear the next line, if it's important.
So what are you up to now, John?
I'll never work again. No,
really?
No.
You're finished?
No, right now, actually. Well, Gangster Squad is running, if it's still in the theaters. Did you hear that it got killed and that I wrote all this thing to the New York Times poo-pooing the critics? I should have done throughout my career. Anyway, that's running right now. I'm starting tomorrow I'm doing voiceover stuff.
Right? How are you?
I've just got a hip replacement, so I'm not running around to be able to act physically yet, but I'm in recovery. So I imagine I'll start getting back on the boards. I'm also recurring in I'm hoping to get back on the boards within the next 2 to 3 weeks, where I'll be able to run, should the occasion arise, where they say, get me John Polito and make sure he can run.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Right.
I don't think it's going to happen. My agents are like, what the hell are you worried about? Nobody wants you to run. You're 62. You never ran your whole life. And I'm recurring on a show called Bunheads for the Disney Network. And, that's a couple of things, and I'm hoping for more.
Good. I try to ask people at the end of our conversation what they say to those hopeful young people that come to them. You know, that when you're at the barbecue, you're at somewhere, and you're the guy from the movies and you're the guy who was, you know,
yeah.
And that young person comes up, they're hungry, go, and the artist.
I can only say to them, if you really, you know, if you really believe old stuff, you really believe, don't listen to anybody who tells you no. I always hated everyone who told me you'll never make it. You're from Southwest Philly. What do you know about that? You know, suck my. At this point, I can say that. But let nobody get in your way. And I don't know what road to tell you to take. But you'll find it. And the other thing is just be really aware of luck and the right place at the right time and jump at it. I mean, that's all I have to say about myself. I think I was very fortunate. But things like what happened with Ellen Stewart happened to me. And there are gifts that happen. So keep open every door. Open every door. Try everything. And I just wish everybody the best in their journey, which will not be in my journey.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You're the greatest.
You
I appreciate
are too,
it.
Man. I'd do anything for you. You're the best.
John, as I said, is a wonderful guy, and I just enjoy speaking with people that I think have played a great role in American theater and movies as working artists for their entire life. John's a great guy, and thanks so much to John for his time. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris King, everybody over at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out with the live show. I'm all over the place live. Come out and see me. Say you listen to the podcast with you. And I'm in Hartford, Connecticut right now as I speak. So if you're in Hartford, anywhere near Hartford, Connecticut, this weekend. So come on out. But I look forward to the next time we talk. So see you then. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.